I think that all of you have probably seen in the visitor center in the chapel the theme of this year's Holden retreats is in the image of God. And what we would like to share during the time that we have together here are some of the images in God's creation of another place and another part of the world, Papua New Guinea. Now, I'm Joel Ingebrigtsen. This is my wife, Paula. And just as a bit of a background, after graduating from the seminary in 1968, I went to Papua New Guinea, at that time with the Missouri Synod, and later joined the American Lutheran Church in 84, and now with the ELCA. And Paula went, I went in that capacity as a pastoral work. Paula went in 1969 in nursing, and you'll hear more about that as we make some input. So perhaps at this point, I'd like to keep that theme in our mind, in the image of God, as we look at the images that we see. And how many of you saw the video that we had yesterday? Did everybody see that? Okay. Part of the way that we would like to work with this is, I think in that video, you probably picked up the technique they were using of going back and using some of the old films from Taylor and Black, and then bringing it up to the present. And that's somewhat the way we would like to approach our presentation this week as well, is looking at things from a traditional point of view and looking at them from today's perspective and finding out where we are in this way of ministry and mission in that part of the world. So Paula, I'll turn it over to you.
One of the first things that people said to me when I came was, in Papua New Guinea, we use this, it's called a bilum in the Melanesian pidgin, which I'll explain later. It's spelled B-I-L-U-M. It's made from different fibers, natural fibers in the environment, although now it's changing. We have some other ones which will develop as the days go by. But this is still in one of the traditional fibers. And people said, have a look inside, peek inside those bilums that the women carry and see what you find sometimes. You'll probably be surprised, and I really was, I must admit, they carried everything. Bilums are expandable. You can stretch them. I used to carry all my books in them when I came back in 78, and I just had this huge thing hanging off my arm after a while, but they just hold more and more and more. They're adaptable, strong, usable kind of things. Come on, pass it around and you all get a feel of it and see what it is. And maybe if you want to pass that on this side, so people get an idea of the texture. Oh dear. I hope nothing. So indeed, if you've seen our poster, Land of the Unexpected. This is Papua New Guinea. And this was a surprise to me. I looked inside and it was a baby in there, and I thought, oh my goodness, surely they don't carry babies in this, you know, net bag. Goodness sakes, why would they do something like that? It took me a while. Let me just put that down on the side there. To realize the value of what this is. It's strong, but yet expandable, so the baby can move in it. But it still gives the baby that feeling of closeness, of warmth, and being close to the mother. Because as you'll realize, the women carry their bilums on their heads. So the child is always there. Or if they bring the child to nurse, then they switch it and hold it. Whoops. In the front. So it comes as a basket then as well. Some will even hang it from here and have it in front of them and be able to nurse exactly like that. Yeah.
Now they're made by hand?
They're made by hand.
Gee, the lines and everything are just perfect.
It is.
And where do they get the fiber?
The fiber, it comes from various sources. Some are from the hemp plant. Some is from bark. Some is from a grassy reed that they'll beat out. And it takes a lot of care to do these. The threads are rolled on their knees to get them the right diameter and strength for what they're going to use it. There's all different types of villains. They hold all different types of things, food items, children, belongings of any sort. So depending on what you're going to use it for, you'll weave it differently.
They use all natural dyes?
This is not all natural dyes. The times have changed in some senses. Yeah, they used to use natural dyes that came from plants, from shells, from clays, from the soil, things like this.
Think of how much packing we'd be doing that.
Yeah, really, this is true. I mean, they carry villains with us.
When we come home.
So it's a very adaptable piece. It's a very useful, it makes good sense. When you live in a country like what you saw, how on earth could you wheel a buggy up those mountains? Yeah, impossible. Or even these carries that we have here, they're great, but they get dirty and they get messy. And this is also, usually people will line it with leaves or whatever. It's disposable, you know, and off it goes. It's little work or whatever, especially if you have children in there. And it's, you know, they're close to mom. And then as you saw, the child in that video too was being weighed. Or sometimes you hang the child in that, in the breezes or whatever, keep the child cool, and they sway in it. Ideal. So a baby's in there, turned from, oh yeah, sure, a baby's in there. It's the most logical place for the child to be. So we've come through a lot of changes within ourselves, and the people have changed a lot too with, like you commented, are these natural dyes? No, they're not. Some of our things have still the traditional dyes in them, but these are probably bought in the store. People change, people adapt. You take from one what you think is good and use it and put it to use if you can. So now I will move into some specifics. Just in case you just to give you a bit of a background again on questions you maybe had. An island nation of a population of 3.8 million and growing. We have one of the highest birth rates in the world over there. It's 3.5, which has been a dramatic change in the last 10, 15 years. Predominantly subsistence farming, 80%, and town and cities are 20% of the population. So again, we still have a pretty much rural area, although we do have the meeting of modern technology, a microsystem for our telephones, videos, TVs, computers, all with Papua New Guineans using all of these things. And yet you have right next door to it the traditional society, still living as it always has, with modifications, but it's still there. They're Melanesians, and it comes from the word Melos in Greek, which is black. This is maybe not totally accurate because you have varying shades of brown to black skin in the country, from extremely light-colored people to very blue-black in some of the islands. We used to be able to tell where people were from by their facial appearance, their skin color, how they dressed. Now with intermarriage between different societies in the country, it's harder to tell where people come from. But that's part of the way to do it. Melanesians comprise Papua New Guinean Irian Jaya. And if you can point up there again, as we explained yesterday, Papua New Guinea is an independent nation on one half of the island.
This is the best one here.
And the other half is Irian Jaya, which is a province of Indonesia after 1968. But it is Melanesian. It is not culturally or racially Indonesian. It is Melanesian. And that's where we have some conflicts now in this area. Solomon Islands, Vanuatu, which you probably knew as the New Hebrides, which have these people who jump off the bungee jumpers that they're the ones, Vanuatu, New Caledonia, and Fiji. So that comprises Melanesia in the Pacific. Papua New Guinea is probably unique in the world. It has 800 distinct languages, not dialects, distinct languages. And this is partially due to the terrain, as you saw. You saw these huge mountains and gullies and valleys, massive swamps in some areas. People just did not mix with their neighbors. They were their enemies. So it was that way.
Excuse me, but I was curious yesterday, this young woman seemed to be able to talk to people in every village she went to. Did she speak all?
She spoke Melanesian Pidgin, which is now a mixed language comprising words and expressions and language forms from some of the islands in the Pacific and directly that are Papua New Guinea. It's taken from the Malay, from traders coming through in the different times, the Germans, because the Germans were part of the governing area, English. It has many words in it from all of that. It is a distinct language. It has its own vocabulary, its own syntax, and what do I want to say? It's a distinct language in itself now.
Even so much that the University of Michigan will allow graduate students to use Melanesian Pidgin as a second language in doing a degree, a higher degree. So, I mean, it is recognized as a language in itself as well as Melanesian Pidgin.
You heard her say, Api noon, Api noon, I think to the two older men who were the gun carriers and that. That means, oh, good afternoon, good afternoon. You can hear it, Api noon, Api noon. You sometimes think you're hearing English. Then you think, no, it's not English. What is it? You know, it's Melanesian Pidgin. So that's become the middle language for people between your 800 distinct languages who can merge and speak it. Quite a few people in Papua New Guinea are now able to at least hear the Pidgin. They may not always speak it or be able to write and read in it, but at least they hear you and they can understand. It's grown and grown. There used to be these two languages as the trading language. Motu, which came from the southern part, from the Papuan region. That has now, it's still there, but it's going into decline. And Melanesian Pidgin is spreading throughout the entire country. English is the predominant language taught and spoken in all of the schools in Papua New Guinea. It's the predominant language in the parliament, which is the governing system, the, what do we call, parliamentary system?
Westminster
system, like Canada would have. Geography. I'll divide it simply into coastal and highland. Coastal has been contacted for 100 plus years. Highlands, 50 plus years. People didn't really believe there was anybody inside this whole area running up here, the major mountain range within the country. And then in the 30s, Jim Taylor was one of the first people to go through and do the patrol to contact different people in these areas, they found masses of people up there, many, many more than there were on the coast. So there's a concentration of population in the highlands to this day, and lesser numbers of people on the coast. Predominant industry would be primary products, which would be forestry and mining on the coast, as well as in the Highlands. Lots of beautiful trees and wood, sometimes just rather indiscriminately. We'll talk about this cut and sent over, chipped up and used that way. Some beautiful woods disappear. Fishing, as you would expect. Copra, cocoa, and coffee, mainly the top two. Coffee is a newer introduction to the lower elevations. Copra being drying of coconut to extract the oil, which we use in a lot of cosmetics, essences, and things like this. Germany is a predominant buyer of that, and I think the U.S. as well. Coffee and tea would be primary export products in the Highlands. Very good quality coffee, some of the best in the world. And unfortunately, what we're producing now over there, I shouldn't say we, I am letting go, I should say, letting go here from this morning. They are now producing marijuana in very good quality. It's called New Guinea Gold in the United States, unfortunately. It's a much easier crop to maintain than coffee or tea or any of these others. It brings a higher price, and it's increasing. So, that's a brief overview of what we know as Papua New Guinea. What are your impressions when we say Papua New Guinea? What brings images to your mind, or what have you heard or remembered that maybe we can help you with now and integrate into this?
Primitive.
All right. Yeah, maybe just take that off. Anything else that you pull out?
Is that all right?
Or should we move it forward? Or? It's all right? Anything else you can think of that Papua New Guinea conjures up?
Well, the temperature of the weather, I've always considered it hot.
Hot, all right. So temperature and weather.
Climate.
Climate, okay. Hot, sticky, steamy. Okay. Maybe we'll just deal with it. Those two as they are. Primitive. Yes, indeed. It's still primitive, as you saw from some of the video and also some of the pictures we'll have here. But as I've said too, we've come into the new age over there as well. And we do have all of the things that you have in this country as well. Not everything, I'm sure. I know we don't. But it's still technologically competitive in that area as well. So it's a contrast.
It's becoming less primitive. Yes.
Yeah.
In most parts, it's becoming less primitive.
I think if we think about that video yesterday, and if we look at that word primitive, kind of the image of what that means, maybe we can divide it into two ways of looking at it. Things that were traditional, and what we're talking about now, things that are modern. And if we think of it in that way, it's kind of misleading too, because it divides things up too carefully, things that were in the past and things that were in the present. I think that maybe what we would attempt to say is that really, from thinking of that primitive image, Papua New Guinea is really a society, a country, a nation that is transitional. It's really between two things, and I think it's important to recognize those statistics that Paula was raising, that primarily you have a country which is 80% agricultural, which would be people living in rural areas, like yesterday when Meg Taylor said that this was her closest approach to paradise, which probably, you know, may be debatable in some ways, but at any rate, that would certainly be a rural subsistence area. Now, the towns and the cities, which comprise the 20%, probably have an overmuch effect on all of that primary area too, because people maybe are looking for some of those things. So you can't really say that Papua New Guinea is only traditional or modern, but it's really a nation that is moving between two things.
Are the people, I think, almost like they'd be like tribes?
It's a tribal society,
tribal society,
yes.
Yeah. And living in, are they living like in huts or
what? I guess,
the
yeah.
The stilts, maybe?
Well, some of them, it depends where you are. Mm-hmm. On the coast, you'll be on stilts to get the air and the breeze, and if you live near a river or whatever, the sea or the river will rise and fall if it's tidal or during the rainy season, so you're up on stilts for various reasons. You do have, they're very secure homes, what to us look like thatched huts, mm-hmm. were strong, double-walled. I know in the highlands, at least when I first came, I thought, a bush house. It wasn't a bush house as such. It was double-walled with strong wood that they had chopped out. Very symmetrical, very aligned. It was insulated in between. The thatch had to be laid in a certain way. You had to have your ridge poles. Everything was orderly and tidy inside. Certain areas were for cooking and heat, certain areas for sleeping, certain areas were for pigs. They even had a fire escape inside it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's most of these houses, again, it's unexpected. It's something we don't realize as what it is, and people coming think it's shabby or poor. It's not. It's making use of what they have there, and it's all biodegradable, if you would. It can be rebuilt and repaired very easily with the help of everybody in the community. So it's more than just a bush hut, which I thought when I got there too. Very sturdy homes.
Yeah. I was just thinking about another thing. When we're talking about language and that word primitive, sometimes when we think of the word primitive, or perhaps maybe it's just my own bias and something that I kind of, in some ways, have always not used that word primitive over there, because it has images for me that are not necessarily positive, but that are maybe reducing things to a level of a simpler. And I think what Paul is saying is that there is even some foresight and planning that goes into very primitive kind of things that we wouldn't maybe have thought was there. And language is one of those. And maybe just to point out again, of those 800 languages, that's 800 out of 6,000 languages in the whole world. So, I mean, that's really an incredible number of languages. But the other important part to think about with those languages, and I think this is where we need to make kind of a mental distinction of what is happening in Papua New Guinea. We talk about culture, and for, say, Alpha, in her presentation on the Mayan culture, it's fairly easy to talk about the Mayan culture, but in Papua New Guinea, given those 800 separate languages, what would you suggest has to be added to the word culture to make it more accurate as to the how we talk about Papua New Guinea?
Would it be area culture?
Well, that would be one way to do it.
Or individual?
That would be another way to do it. Or another way to do it would just be to add the essence that we're talking about cultures and not culture. And it's interesting, the map, even in the dining room lobby there, no, it's in the dining room itself, isn't it? That's right. The one on the left-hand side as you go out on this end. Shows accurately that that map was done in 1983, and it shows accurately that Papua New Guinea is Papua New Guinea. But on the other side, what Paula was talking about, the East Irian side, which belongs to Indonesia, they still list that as New Guinea, which is really, and this kind of reflects the confusion that we have about our geography and as we look in various parts of the world. So we haven't quite gotten some of these things. Everything, of course, changes so much that we can't possibly be up to date all the time anyway. But at least in that area, cultures is really the key thing, because you can't really describe Papua New Guinea just as one particular thing and say that represents Papua New Guinea. On the one hand, it makes it hard to deal with it, but on the other hand, it's an honest way to say it too. And it's easy if you can't answer a particular question about something, you can say, well, but that's another part of the, if someone hears something else. So, cultures, and I think there was one other thing that I wanted to say about that, but I'm not sure just exactly what it was, so I'll leave it at the moment. But
is there any sense of a dominant group of people in terms of government and business and that kind of stuff? I mean, certainly within a number of countries around the world, I mean, Tanzania for one, there's a certain group of people that are considered business people and so on, and it's always a kind of a challenge when you deal with that.
Not really in Papua New Guinea. That's the difficult thing when we're dealing with, like you said, a tribal society. You're divided still according to tribal loyalties and whatever within the government. Although it's divided regionally, you'll still find people divided on tribal basis. Within the country, you really don't find any one group dominating, although in general you might say the Highlanders are the more aggressive in getting out there and getting things done and, you know, getting things for themselves. They've traditionally been like that. I think just because of their beautiful climate they've been able to thrive, and that's who they are, as opposed to the more easier going people on the coast where it's warmer and hot and sticky and miserable like you remember, you would think of it very much. There really isn't a dominant group, or would you say?
Yeah, I would kind of agree with that, in that, say, the Highlanders have always had more of the marketing skills, and they've been more aggressive in that way. On the other hand, the coastal people who have had contact much longer are more sophisticated. They have ways of doing things that facilitate, well, putting their point of view across. But in the system the way it is, it really, you know, there tends to be a balance somewhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is this coastal highland kind of antagonism, if you want to say it that way, that people say, well, they're really, you know, we've had a prime minister who's been from the coast or from the islands for 4 years. Now we need to have a prime minister from the highlands to balance it off. And sometimes they will try to get somebody from the highlands to be the deputy prime minister and do it like that. It doesn't always work. But no, in a sense, it really is who can learn to do what the best. And I guess one thing that I remembered what I wanted to say about language in terms of this primitive description is that one of the largest language groups, and one in which we worked, and one which has a lot of impact with economics, we'll talk about later in the week, is the Enga. Now, one of the things that we more or less had to do, I probably more than Paula in her work, but learning that language, finding that you're dealing with six tenses, you know, which is really, a bit more complicated than what I was used to dealing with. So when you're talking about languages, language is very technical and very developed.
What kind of a communication system have they developed over there? Because they'd have to if they have a government.
The different tribes, can they understand people, a language from another tribe or not?
Okay, well, those two questions are related. Paula, maybe you want to just...
That's all right, because they are related. I'll just say Melanesian Pidgin has now brought people together and people can converse, although you'll still find more remote areas where Melanesian Pidgin is not really understood by the majority of the group. You may have a few people who've come to a town or a city and have learned it by hearing it and speaking it. But predominantly, people now will be able to communicate in some way using Melanesian Pidgin. And then with this, the modern communication system, you might want to deal with that one a little bit.
I'm not sure.
Did you mean what is like telephones
with,
and
communicating over the miles, being it so hard to travel around with all the hills, and also the language?
Okay, all right. The country is divided really into 19 provinces, and then within those provinces, of course, there are groups that would be completely separate or formally completely separate. But each province has its own radio station. There's a national radio station. People have access to satellite dishes, so they're getting regular broadcasts if you have the resources to do that from Australia, which in turn will bring you General Hospital and all these good things that people see around here. We're going to talk about that in a way. That's one of the, before we close, we want to just pass around some photos that try to highlight, I guess, because what we want to do today is to highlight the tension in which a growing, developing country like Papua New Guinea lives, between traditional, not only industry, but traditional values, because that's very important, how people see themselves and their life and their relationship to others, those very basic things. And tomorrow we're going to talk about values and relationships. And these kind of things that have come in terms of modern communication have changed the whole face of Papua New Guinea too, because people are able to communicate much more rapidly. And at the same time, it offers the opportunity for people to be more less connected to each other too, because communication just kind of hits at the surface sometimes, and people can even be misinformed. And a lot of times people will be on the coast going to school, say they're at the seminary, and that would happen sometimes. Someone would ring them on the telephone from the highlands and say, your brother was killed in an automobile accident and somebody from so-and-so place was driving it, or was driving the car, and would stir up a lot of emotions and a lot of bad feelings, but the information might turn out to have even been entirely wrong. So communication, maybe sometimes it's better to have slower communication and get the facts straight rather than have everything come so quickly that it gets people upset and excited. And when you're talking about death and that sort of thing, it creates complications in people's lives over there too, because there are certain ways that you have to deal with that. So, but it is possible now to make that kind of quick communication. Although
I just assume they didn't watch this General Hospital or some of those TV shows.
Well, I never did see. What is the one that I was seeing? That but that one is
Gilligan's Island
is around.
Yeah, one of those wonderful ones.
Yeah, and I'm afraid that when we talk about values, we have to look at what is the impact of modern technology and communication, not only in Papua New Guinea but other countries, and probably here in our own culture as well.
Well,
those are issues, yes.
I have a question on the economics. Did you mean Beth?
Paula.
Paula, when Paula mentioned marijuana, how did that get in there, that that would be a product?
It was
who introduced it? Who gave them the idea that it could be something?
People like you and me walking over there and finding out, this looks like a good place to start. It was brought in, I think, fairly simply on a personal use originally. People who came into the country working there brought it in on their own, and I think that's kind of how it started. It's now grown into an industry where
it's making money.
We're going to talk more about this too later in terms of the crisis that the country faces, but just on that, when I was teaching at the seminar and we're living in Leh, one of the teachers there from Australia had a plant in his yard, and all of a sudden someone realized that that was a marijuana plant.
He didn't realize it.
So
it had been brought, you know,
brought it to the staff meeting and said, this happens to be marijuana. That was back in 77. Now everybody would probably really, you know what that is, and that's one of the clashes of the changes. But and I just you raised that point on climate, and that's in light of what Catherine said too. I think that is important. We've lived in both climates, on the coast and in the highlands, and certainly in the highlands you feel much more fit. I mean, I think if you're living up here at Holden, you're probably fitter than you would maybe feel if you were living in Florida and it was hot and humid, or in the Southwest, whatever the case might be. And I think it's much the same there. And over a period of time, illness and that sort of thing takes it out of people. And maybe another answer to what you're asked too, Catherine, is that the lifespan of politicians and people like that is not so long either, because of you don't have the same people around all the time. That's part of it. The toll is taken. All right, any other things that you have on your mind right now? We might move on just a little bit.
At some point I'd like to hear a little bit what's happening. When you talk about the transition and kind of clashes between traditional and the so-called modern approach, certainly, things have not been easy in Leh and some other places in terms of crime and so on. And what's happening there in terms of the young people being educated, and educated to do what, right? I mean, what jobs do you fill, and how do you fit back into a culture, your own home, when you're suddenly a different person and all of that kind of stuff? And maybe talk about that later.
Yeah, if I could,
that's a
very good point in that, and we're going to deal with that one under that title, the crisis today,
yeah.
Education
okay.
and health, because I think that's a very important one about not only what is happening in Papua New Guinea, that specifically, but mm-hmm. I think in other parts of the world too, because we're talking about global issues in mission today,
mm-hmm.
and education is certainly one that we want to get into. So if I can...
Sure, that's fine.
All right, thanks. But it does raise some things that we wanted to get into a little bit.